I'm Robert White, and I'm a recovered heroin addict. And I'm also an alumni of Austin Recovery. I came through here. So I came through here in November 2010, very reluctantly and dragging my feet. And I guess I'll just kind of open with that. Through identification, you know, I started, took my first drink at the age of 12. And I don't know, something happened when I took that first drink. I can't really explain it, but it was almost like that arriving feeling that, you know, everything is going to be okay. And it's funny because upon hindsight, looking back in reflection, I was with a buddy. His name was Ryan. And we raided my dad's liquor cabinet. And we were setting out to just share a glass of whatever we were drinking. And we ended up finishing the whole bottle. And you know, of course, I got quite sick, but it's just kind of like that subtleness, and I haven't really thought about that till recently about, like, I thought I had a choice in the matter on how much I was going to drink, and even my first time drinking, I lost all control. You know, and the reason I say I identify as a heroin addict is that's the fellowship I participate in. I participate in AA as well, but I think identification is very important. Especially early on. You know, there's a lot of opinions. In my experience, I can identify as, you know, a lot of different things. But if I'm in a meeting or, you know, an actual 12-step fellowship meeting and I'm talking about alcoholism and it's in an HA meeting, you know, maybe a heroin addict's in there and, you know, now he thinks that this isn't the place for him. So that's why I identified as a heroin addict. You know, upon taking that first drink, it wasn't like I drank every day afterwards. It wasn't like I just, you know, kept drinking. You know, I dibble-dabbled with it here and there. And that progressed to other substances, you know, throughout high school and, well, I guess junior high first and high school. And I guess the first thing that, you know, kind of was more important than the drugs and alcohol was my love for football. You know, I'm from Odessa, Texas, so all we really have there is football, oil, and drugs and alcohol. You know, that's home of the place called Friday Night Lights. I'm not sure if y'all know what that is. So I went to Odessa Permian. And yeah, shout out. So I played football. I was a place kicker and a punter. I had a bright future ahead of me if I could just do the next right thing. But my alcoholism and drug addiction got in the way. You know, my senior year, I'd gotten a DUI and got honest with the football coach. So I got suspended 3 games. And then I got to participate the rest of the season. I got 2 letters from, one was Arizona State and the other Texas A&M. So I went and visited Texas A&M. And all I really had to do was apply to that school, and I never applied. That whole year, that whole college, or not college, that whole summer, I decided to go on a bender. You know, it's time to celebrate. So it's like these little things, and there's several different stories I could tell where, you know, I can stay sober for a period of time, right? But whenever that important appointment was to be met, I always failed, right? Because of this. This mental obsession, this spiritual malady, and then once I put it into my body, I lose all control. That's the physical allergy. But kind of backtracking, or I guess forward tracking to Austin Recovery, what led me into Austin Recovery was I was on deferred probation, and I was driving back from San Antonio to Austin. I just scored some heroin, and of course I was nodding out, and I wasn't driving too I wasn't in the lanes, you know, I was swerving in and out of the lanes, and I got pulled over, and I got picked up for possession of controlled substance. And mind you, this was my, I'd been to 3 treatment centers prior to this. And so I got pulled over, of course, you know, they asked me if I had anything on me, of course I lied, and they ended up finding my stash, and they put me in Comal County Jail. By this point, you know, my family is kind of fed up with my BS. And So, you know, I made a last-ditch effort, you know, threw some Hail Mary prayers, called my mom, because she's the enabling one in my family. I called her, and for a last-ditch effort, I said, you know, I'll do whatever it takes. She said, all right, you know, you need to go to detox. I found you a detox, and this one, Austin Recovery still had the location off Cross Park. So I was like, yeah, I need to do that, but I need like a couple weeks to get my affairs in order. Now, mind you, like, I'm living, I don't have a job. I'm, living in an apartment with a girlfriend at the time. And so my only affairs are getting high, right? So she reluctantly bailed me out, and I had every intention of going to get my affairs in order, you know, packing my stuff up, but my car drove away from Austin and went right back to the dope house, right? And this is, like, the reasons that I have to stay sober are, so I just violated deferred probation with another felony, so I'm looking at a minimum of 5 years in TDCJ, so I have all the reasons in the world to not get high, yet I go get high again. Right? And I think it's important to notice, like, I don't have a choice in the matter. If I'm the real addict, if I'm the real alcoholic, there's no choosing. If I leave tonight and go to the liquor store or wherever, or the dope house, like, I'm not making a choice to do that. Right? And I was confused for a long time in that, well, yeah, I am. My feet are going that way. I'm consciously making a choice to pick that substance up and put it in my body. So I would kind of, you know, if you're having trouble with that lack of power, or you think you have the power to choose, one, you may, right? You may just be a hard drinker, a hard user. But if you can identify with some of my story, you might be just like me, just like other people in this room. You might be the real addict and the real alcoholic. So I would encourage you to look at your experience honestly. Because there's no way that I'm going to choose to go shoot more heroin, pending, you know, sitting 5 years at a place that I don't really care to be at. That just doesn't make sense. So I finally get to detox. And, you know, I know the game. They put me on Suboxone. I'm taking Suboxone to taper down so I can come out to the ranch. And, you know, so I stay there for 2 days, and on the third day, I'm like, I refuse medications. Because I'm already planning to go use again, right? I'm in the insanity still. So, you know, after that 24 hours of no medications, they can't hold me. So, you know, I go and, you know, go get some more heroin. And I asked if I could come back, right? Because I wasn't going to go get high. And they said, so long as you come back sober. Of course, you know, that didn't happen. So I came back, and, you know, I lied to them upon admission. They asked me, you know, if I'd been getting high anymore, and I said no, you know, because I wanted to get into the ranch, you know, because I'm not really going into the Austin Recovery to get sober. I'm going in here to get rid of the back problems, right? So the court's on my back, the mom's on my back, dad's on my back. So that was what led me in here. Now, I did have a powerful experience in here, and I stayed sober about a year and 3 months when I left in 2010. And I can tell you I still had a reservation, though, because I got high again. I got drunk again. And my reservation was like, until this happens, I'm not really clear on the exact line that my head bought, right? Because what a reservation is this idea that, you know, I'll stay sober until this day, or, you know, I'll give up alcohol, but pot, you know, it's natural. I can smoke that forever. You know, on that, like, my delusion was smashed by a group of men here in Austin around that idea around pot, is that everything is natural, even methamphetamines, right? It all comes from the earth. So, you know, it's not a good excuse anymore. Yeah, exact clean drug. Yeah, exactly. Like, leaving here, I enrolled in a sober living house. I, you know, took action in the 12 steps. And I noticed something, like, once again, through hindsight in this recovery, that, you know, I was more about, like, sharing at people. Like, I was on a pedestal, right? I was not equal when I walked into a room. I was, like, better than. I was, like, I was the recovered alcoholic and drug addict, which we all can recover. You know, if you think you can just be recovering, I'm not going to debate you on that. That's your experience, right? But the book tells me that we can recover. But I was speaking more on a pedestal, right? Like, I put myself on this pedestal, and through staying sober and being dishonest, right, holding on to these reservations, I ended up, so I had to go serve, so I had to turn myself in to Denton County. And instead of it being 5 years in TDCJ, it got reduced to 2.5 years. And I got released after 7 months. And I actually was able to carry the message in jail, and never felt more free in my life, except for now. But in that sobriety, never felt more free in my life than whenever I was behind the jail bars. I was able to help a lot of men in there, and it's kind of weird, right? Like, I was completely, like, in my addiction, I was confined to my mind, right, into the jail cell of my mind, and being locked up for the first 4 months before I started participating in dishonest actions, I never felt more free in my life. So if you're looking, like, if anyone's looking at some certain similar circumstances, like possible going back into jail, prison, whatever it is, you can walk through that unscathed. Your story doesn't have to, you know, end like mine. Like, you can stay sober in all circumstances. So I got transferred to Mineral Wells pre-parole, pre-release facility. And, you know, I was like, well, I'm on my way out. And so my mind started talking to me. You know, a lot of people were smoking cigarettes, selling cigarettes. There was other activities going on in there. And I was like, you know, what's it going to hurt to start smoking cigarettes? And so I started lying to my mom about, you know, you got commissary, but then you also have, you know, other forms of, what is the word for it? Like, well, yeah, that's basically what it would be. Currency, other forms of currency. Contraband, yeah. So they had, like, those dot cards or whatever. Where you could put money on these cards. And so I was telling my mom, like, you've got commissary, but then you have these other green dot. You got these green dot cards, and that's another form of commissary. So I was lying to her. And so I started buying cigarettes. I was still, you know, going through my spiritual disciplines, communicating with my sponsor. And one thing led to another, right? Like, the hardest lie to tell is the first lie, in my experience. And after that, it's like all the other things become easier to tell. So one night I was smoking a cigarette with my cellmate, and I started getting this, like, this weird feeling, right? Like, this foggy feeling coming over me. And he had spiked it with K2. So immediately I'm resentful but kind of relieved. And I'm at a crossroads in recovery where I can either get honest about this, like call my sponsor, talk to someone else in the prison system that's in recovery, or I can just keep this little secret to myself. So I opted for the second one. And I don't know if you're familiar with Jim's story about whiskey and milk, but that was my experience. So long as I mixed K2 with tobacco, I could smoke it. Right, so I continued to participate in dishonest actions, and eventually I got released April 28, 2012, and I've been sober ever since then. But it's these justifications and rationalizations that keep me locked up. And it's this, like, this dishonesty. Like, I classify dishonesty. So I classify dishonesty not in the aspect. So I say, like, if I'm holding a big lie from Courtney, my wife, like, what do you think? Like, how mad is she going to get? Like, if it's a big lie, you know, like, she's going to get pretty pissed. Right? But if it's a small lie, maybe she'll just, like, sweep it under the rug, let bygones be bygones. All right, so that's how I classify lies. And it's not in the sense of, like, what they're going to think of me. Well, somewhat it is that, but it's really like what I'm going to think of me, and how this person's going to affect me, right? So, like, my experience with dishonesty is a lie is a lie is a lie, right? There's no, like, partial truth, right? Like, it's either this is the truth or this is false, right? But my delusion allows me to classify, like, I'm going to tell part of the story, right? Or I'm going to exaggerate. Like, I used to want to tell the story, like around the football, like that I was, like, that they were looking at, like they were going to give me a scholarship because I thought that would look better, right? Like, that, my mind used to think in that way. And so that's not the truth, though, right? Like, I wasn't going to get a scholarship. I was going to have to walk on and earn it because place kickers and punters aren't, like, the best positions on the team. Like, they're vital, like, in a close game, but it's not, like, you know, that's not what they're saving their scholarships for. You have to earn that. You know, the same thing goes with resentment, right? Like, I've got, like, a little resentment or a big resentment. And in my experience, like, even the little resentments have the power to kill, right? And so now, like, if you're on your fourth step, you know, what I would encourage you to do is, like, you know, who's annoying you, right? Like, who's irritating you? Like, put them down. Because those are probably resentments. For a long time, like, I didn't write inventory on my mom because I justified and rationalized that this is the woman who brought me into the world. Like, how could I be mad at her? You know, she helped me out of every situation, every crazy circumstance. Like, how could I ever be resentful at her? But I was. You know, so I guess, like, going back to getting released, like I told you, my old sobriety date, like whenever I went to Austin Recovery, was November 8, 2010. So whenever I got released from prison, I kept that sobriety date, right? So I was like, you know, K2's not, you know, drug. I wasn't shooting heroin. I drank some hooch, but who wouldn't, you know, who under similar circumstances wouldn't do the same thing as me, right? So once again, like a justification and rationalization that, like, I'm unique, I'm different, and I get to bend the rules as they apply to me. So I started going through the steps with a sponsor immediately. So some key important differences from, like, other recoveries when I had, like, you know, 30, 60, 90 days I was able to keep together. I think the longest before, like, Austin Recovery was, like, 6 months. But I never was sold on the ideas contained in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in 2012, when I got released, I met a group of men that, I don't know, something was different. I think I was kind of finally beaten to a place of hopelessness where I was tired of trying to do things my way. And I was willing to start doing things a different way. I was willing to start take some direction. So they sat me down and we started going through this book page by page. And I began to, instead of looking for the differences in this text, because this book was written in the 30s, I started to identify with the similarities, even though I shot heroin, right? Even though I did other substances. And I began to have an experience. And when it came to the fifth step, you know, I was cringing. Right, because I've got this secret about, you know, getting high in prison. So I had this great idea. It's like, I'll tell, you know, because I was going to read the fifth step to two guys. I'm going to tell part of the story to this guy, and then whenever I'll tell the rest of the story to this other guy. And so that's what I did. And there was this little kind of like this intuitive thought that kept saying, like, you need to get honest about this. So I was willing to get honest, but it had to be on my terms. So I kept praying for the willingness. And, like, I was very active, you know, first 30, like, before I was 30 days sober, I was, you know, people didn't know I had 30 days sober, so that kind of probably would have made a difference. But I was bringing meetings out to Austin Recovery. I was sponsoring men. You know, I had a home group, and I continue to have those things in my life today. But the obsession to drink or use never came back during this whole time while I was lying about my sobriety date. But the thought that, like, the longer I kept this secret, the more I thought, like, I don't know, I wouldn't say, like, suicide was an option. I guess suicide was more of an option than getting high or drunk, right? Because I didn't want to ever put anything into my body again. And that was at a scary place, right? Being completely sober, having to act out this stage character as a recovered member of, you know, 12-step fellowships, it was hard to keep up the role, right? And I was managing a sober house. And, you know, basically I was living a lie. You know, I was, you know, telling people, you know, you have to have rigorous honesty, but I was keeping this little secret, justifying and rationalizing the whole time. And I remember it like, you know, clear as day to day. It was like a month before I got honest. At the sober house I managed, the guys came home and they were like 3 minutes late. And so I pulled up the, I pulled out the big book and I went to page 62. And I, of course, you know, I sat him down and, you know, gave him the fear of God. But I yelled at this to them. I yelled, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us, seemingly without provocation. But we invariably find that at some time in the past, we have made decisions based on self, which later place us in a position to be hurt. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. God makes that possible. Right? So I read that to them. Well, I didn't read it to them. I yelled it at them. And then I was like, you know, you got 8 p.m. curfew the rest of the weekend or some, like, I, you know, made a, just, I was being mean. And so I go back to my room and I'm sitting there and like, I just like get overwhelmed. And I start just crying. Right. And I had this realization that like, I was not reading that to them. I needed to hear that. That was for me. Right. That I'd been living this lie in recovery. And that was okay so long as I was willing to get honest about it, but how I'd been carrying myself within, you know, that instance, you know, I needed to clean that up. So a month later I got honest about it. And I, you know, like leading up to it, we were driving out to this conference and, like leading up to getting honest, I would ask my best friend, like, you know, if you got a secret, you know, yeah, how do you tell or what do you think? Like, he's like, why don't you just get honest about it? So I went and talked to this old timer in recovery, and you know, it was just like this complete fear that this man was going to judge me. And I got honest about it, and he was like, okay, so what? You know, so like I make like big deals about things that really aren't that big of a deal because I'm not unique. That's why, like in the fifth step, like when you tell your deepest, darkest secrets to a man or a woman, and they're just sitting there, like, okay. And they share some of their stuff, and you're like, oh, dang, I wasn't as bad as that guy. Right? It allows me to, like, get right-sized again, right? Like, I'm not, like, the director. I'm not the center of the universe. Like, everything I've been through is not really that unique. Now, in the same instance of that, like what Blake was talking about whenever he opened the meeting up, like, some of us are going to be able to help other people that some of us aren't, right, due to our circumstances that got us here, right? And that's why I say, like, identification is key, right? Like, if I'm just a pure heroin addict, like, later on, like, me and an alcoholic might be able to understand each other because the solution is the same. But he didn't, well, he may have shot alcohol. Some people do that. But he's not going to understand, like, my intense craving for heroin, right? Because he's just a pure alcoholic, right? But at some level, we'll be able to identify. I don't know. What time we got here? 8 o'clock. All right. So, that was pretty quick, right? So, I don't know. I'd like to dive into, like, some of the solution. I hope I covered enough to identify as the real addict. I think I kind of did. But some of the things, like, that I identify with this book, like, that really kind of caught my attention. Is in the doctor's opinion. So if you have your big book, check it out. And, like, I didn't like this, like, obviously, whenever I was still trying to manage my life and not fully concede to my inner myself that I was the real addict or the real alcoholic. But on XXVIII, the first paragraph, the doctor says, "We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol or, you know, drugs on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve." And so, like, reason that, like, that paragraph is really important to me even still today is, like, me sober, like, if I'm not putting my reliance upon recovery and a power greater than myself, my problems still pile up on me and become astonishingly difficult to solve. Like, it was evident when I was using drugs and alcohol, like, problems were happening, right? Like, I say something in my drunken stupor, or when I'm high, I don't remember things. Like, I promised, you know, my grandparents that I'm going to show up at this time and I don't arrive. Like, so those are really, like, easy, like, whenever I'm on the particular substance. But, like, what about when I'm sober, right? Like, these problems continue to pile up on me, and I get frustrated. I get discontent. I get irritable. Like, what is the first thing I'm going to do, like, if I'm having a bad day or a good day, right? Mainly in this talk, like, if I'm having a bad day, like, for this example, like, what am I usually going to turn to, right? The drugs and the alcohol. Right, and I think I'm making a choice to do that. And in my experience, every time I drink, every time I take a drug, like, I don't drink the drink; the drink takes me. Right? Like, has anyone ever thought to themselves, like, okay, I'm gonna start off with just a few. I'm just gonna smoke a few joints, and then, like, hours later, you know, I'm completely high. Does anyone identify with that? Cool. It's getting hot in here. The other aspect, like, that really kind of pulled me with a vision in 2012 is on page 84. And this is the 10th step promises. Because I don't know if anyone else in here, like stopping wasn't entirely always too difficult. Like, as my disease progressed, it became harder to stop. But, like, coming to treatment and staying stopped, or going to detox or jail or whatever it was, like, I could stay stopped during those brief periods. But, like, staying stopped permanently, right? Like, being restored to sanity, right? Like, that's something I could never even fathom. Right, and so on page 84, it talks about the 10th step promises, and I kind of want to share that with you. So if you have your big book, go to page 84. It says that it's the last paragraph at the bottom of the page. It says, "And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for by this time sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor or drugs. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically." Right? That's a big deal for a person like me, right? Like, not reacting to life where anything that doesn't go my way, I just go take a drink, or I go back to the dope dealer, or I go get some weed, whatever the case may be. Like, today, like, I'm able to sometimes pause, not all the time. And, you know, like, just like an experience recently, right? Like, me and Courtney were, like, poking back and forth at each other. But, like, because, like, spirituality is an important role in my life, like, it's what's grounded me, I'm able to reach out to people, right? I'm always directed back to power, which is the power greater than myself, right? And I can always have the opportunity to clean up my wrongdoings. I don't know, some cool stuff, I guess, like, speaking about Courtney. So I got married in May, so that's pretty awesome. So So we've been together for nearly a year, and we haven't killed each other yet. No. We've almost went there. But she's in recovery. It's kind of funny. Like one of us will either come and make amends quicker than the other, just depending on how spiritually fit we are that day. It's usually her, right? I don't know. I got the opportunity to, I guess this time around, like really figure out what my purpose in life was, right? And I got to figure that out because early on in recovery, me and my family opened up a sober living house. So while, you know, my primary purpose as an active member in recovery is to help other addicts and alcoholics, but now my business is the same thing. And I really found that I had, like, you know, I was good at it, right? And from that, like, you know, always, like, keeping God first, right? Always maintaining a sponsor, right? I've had a sponsor since I've been sober. I've had sponsees since I've been sober. I've always had a service commitment or an H&I where I've been responsible to bring a meeting out to at least every week. I've had a home group. It's changed, right, like over the years, but I've always had a home group. I believe in that. But it's like this internal peace, like in relationships, right? Not only business, like I get to bring like the freedom that I got in the 12 steps from taking action in the 12 steps. I get to take that into my business. So it's been a really powerful experience. My relationship with my family is absolutely amazing. Right, like I have keys to all their houses, like they put me in their will, like it's pretty powerful stuff. And I know like the family doesn't always come back, right? Like some of you like may not have that experience, so you don't have to have like the things that I'm sharing don't have to happen to you for you to have an experience in recovery. But I think more importantly is like I get present, like. Like where I find myself most present is in places like this, right? Like sharing my experience, strength, and hope, right? Not wondering, like, you know, am I going to have to like tell this lie so I can tell this lie? Like it brings me closer to power, and it's become the most important part of my life, right? And it's like tonight I'm out here for fun and for free, right? And I never would have done something like unless I was going to get something. Like I would never go somewhere to dedicate some time, right? Like unless y'all were going to give me something. So like, it, you know, it's pretty amazing. I don't know. I just started a men's meeting recently, and it's an accountability group. And that's been pretty powerful just to like remain willing, honest, and open, no matter how long I stay sober. And like remain open-minded to the fact that, you know, just because this guy has a little less time than me or this guy has more time than me, like what they're giving me for guidance could be accurate. Like, and really like going and sitting with that, right? Because I never know when God's going to speak to me. I don't know. We just bought a house. That's crazy. So that's brought up some financial fear. You know, it's we got two dogs, so we don't have any kids yet, so that's good. yet, right? I don't know what else to say. I mean, if you're sitting in here struggling, like get out of the way and talk to someone, right? Like you've got a host of people around you, and like you can start helping people like before you get out of here. Like, you have a unique message that someone needs to hear. And I think it's vital for us to know that because I thought, you know, what can I give to this world after taking everything, right? Like, I was just a complete taker, right? And I can still be selfish today. And that's to be said, like while I have recovered, it doesn't mean, like, I'm cured, right? It doesn't mean that I'm perfect, even though sometimes I think I am. Like I'm going to continue to make mistakes, but if everything was just like good, like I come to a recovery center or, you know, I come to the rooms of recovery and, you know, I get, you know, my 30-day chip and then I'm good. Like what would be the purpose of coming back? What would be the purpose of like staying in this book? What would be the purpose of having a sponsor and some sponsees? What would be the purpose, right? Like, if the answer was just God, like, this book wouldn't need to exist, right? Like, just find God. That's all it would be, is one sentence. And while it is, like, it is about a power greater than yourself, like, we read it in How It Works, there is one who has all power, that one is God. May you find him now, right? And, like, what does that mean, may you find him now? That means, like, right here in this moment, right? Like, what are you thinking about, right? Like, other than what's going on right here, right now, right? Because you may have just missed something, right? And that's the thing, like, I'm always driven to is, like, where are my feet at now? And because I am an addict, like, I get caught up in, you know, what's going to happen tomorrow or what's going to happen next week or, you know, I wish I wouldn't have done that last year, whatever it may be. But because, you know, I've got a host of men and women around me that are always challenging me to stay present, stay current, like, I get to be humbled and come back to this present moment. You know, I do, I think I already said this, I have a sponsor that, and my sponsor has a sponsor. I think that's important. I have a home group. My home group's Paint It Black every Thursday night at 8 p.m. It's Heroin Anonymous. So if you want to look me up, you can find me there every Thursday night. If you don't have a sponsor, I would encourage you getting one. Don't sponsor yourself. You know, if your thinking was the main problem, then, you know, you're probably not going to outthink this. And have a good time. All right, well, that's about it. Thank you.